in from the backwoods of New Jersey. Welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Our guest today is a powerhouse vocalist, Todd Michael Hall. People know this guy. You're the voice of Riot 5, but he's also had a lot of other stuff. He's done Jack Starr's Burning Star, Reverence, a slew of solo material. We're going to touch on all that stuff tonight, but please welcome to the show, Todd Michael Hall.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, guys. I'm really, really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking some time to talk to us tonight. And before we get started, we got to wish you a slightly belated happy birthday.
Yeah. It was funny because I ended up having a performance on my birthday. It wasn't supposed to, just happened on Saturday with a local band. We did a bunch of cover tunes and then three of my originals. And then my one buddy that came to the show, he showed me a picture and he's like, I was with you 1 year ago today. And 1 year ago today, on my birthday, Riot had played in Bay City in my local town. So like the next town over. So like I have two birthdays in a row. I will tell you, being in a band, there's no respect for birthdays and holidays and anniversaries and all that. It's like I'm pretty much always gone for stuff. I even missed my sister's wedding to go out on a tour with Primal Fear. So it's like I'm in the doghouse all the time,
Oh man. So I mean, like I said, there's a bunch of stuff you had. Everybody might know you from the high profile thing of Riot 5, but there's a lot of other stuff you've done. So I know Tom wants to start it off with maybe some of the early stuff and we'll work our way forward.
Well, I'm the perfect guy to do that because I'm a big indie CD collector and I have the original copy of the Hallwood CD. And it was funny when your name started to get more circulated years after the fact, I made the connection of that. And I mean, the CD subsequently got reissued with bonus tracks. But if you could talk to us a little bit about how that band came about and what the indie hard rock slash metal scene was like around that time.
What happened, my older brother, John, he was 4 years older than me. He always had a band going. And so what happened is I would always sit down in the basement and watch him play. And I was always singing, just ever since I was a wee lad. And finally, I think about the time I was 15, he got into a spot where they needed a singer. And I was 15 looking 13, I'm sure. But I ended up performing with him in it would have been like in January, February of 1985, because it was just 40 years ago, this past winter. And like I said, it was cover tunes. It was local, some local bars, but we'd go play what they call jamborees, where bands just go play and, for the bar owners just see if they can get booked and all that kind of stuff. And the funny part is I was in high school. I couldn't even drive yet. I was in high school. I would get home at like 2 o'clock in the morning, but I was a straight A student in high school. So my mom was always like, whatever, as long as you get your homework done, knock yourself out. So it's kind of ridiculous actually. But I wasn't a drinker or partier. I mean, I think probably I would be the designated driver at that point. Cause that was never my thing. And then what happened is it eventually just kind of, well, I got out of the band and then, cause I was not a, I hadn't developed my high voice yet. And so, I did it for, a few months, 6 months or whatever. I got out, worked on my voice a bit. My brother John kept doing cover tunes. And my brother John would always oscillate. He'd be like, well, let's do cover tunes. Oh, I want to do originals. Let's do cover tunes. He would always oscillate back and forth. And we reached a point where he wanted to work on originals. And he started working with this local band. He kind of had it going. They were called Wrought Iron for a little while. And but finally changed the name to Harlot. And at first they were kind of cover tunes, but then I kind of joined the band as they switched to originals. And kind of what led into it, though, was like I had been developing my voice, trying to learn how to sing. And I specifically remember there was one instance where I have two older brothers, and I called them both in like to our bedroom. We had this one shared bedroom, you know. And I'm like, I can sing that note from Take Hold of Flame, you know, like that. And I pulled them in. My other brother, Rick, played it on the stereo on a vinyl or something. And I sang along with it and hit the big opener note for them. And in typical brother fashion, they just kind of went, and walked away. But then shortly after that, my brother John was like, hey, you know, do you want to sing in the band? And so we started, you know, writing originals together. And we recorded a demo actually while I was still in high school, you know, just like 8-track type stuff. And then after I graduated high school, my freshman year in college, I was going to the University of Michigan, and I sold my car so that we could afford the studio. I had like a Triumph TR7. I had bought it with my paper route and work money and all that kind of stuff. And I sold that for like $3,500 or I don't know, and paid for studio time. We recorded at a studio down in Fenton, Michigan, where Grand Funk had recorded. There's a guy named Al Hirsch, Hirschen, Al Hirsch, I think, or it's Hirschberger, Hirschenberger, or something like that. But he had produced albums by Ted Nugent and stuff like that. He didn't produce our album, but it was his studio. And that's where we recorded 25 Gets a Ride many, many years ago. That big old thick, you know, 2-inch tape and everything back in the day where they would, it was so crazy. They would, you know, you'd be, oh, re-sing that part. And then they would pop you in and pop you out, the
Yeah.
guy at the board and all that crazy stuff. Yeah, it was so bizarre to think I started in those days and now everything's so much different. You know, people can record from all parts of the world and just email their tracks in and mix it all together. It's so much different.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you talked about you mentioned Take Hold of the Flame, and I was telling Tom prior listening to the album again, The Harlot, and it reminded me of like and what we talked about, like it's almost got a little bit of like that period late 80s. I don't want to say hairband stuff, but in that mold. But I hear like Queensryche. So was Jeff Tate like a big influence?
Oh, he was a huge influence on me. He and Eric Adams from Manowar are my two big influences. I mean, I was influenced by a lot of high singers back then, but I always just thought Jeff was the best, with Eric kind of being right up there too. Probably Jeff wins out just because my voice is more like his. You know, my voice is hopelessly clean, whereas Eric can do that gritty stuff that I'm just like not even capable of doing. So, but yeah, I think back then my brother John, you know, we were young, you know, and I look at that album and the songwriting was not very mature. And I think my brother John was into Stu Hamm and this and that, whatever, you know, and so I mean, you'd be playing songs, all of a sudden they'd be like the dee doo 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 dee doo doo dee doo, and like these harmony bass guitar runs and all this crazy stuff. And it was like I like and even me as a singer, I listen back to it and I have to laugh. There's scream here, a scream there, a scream, you know, like I was doing everything I could to impress everybody. So like I liken it to, you know, not to tease younger musicians, but a lot of times younger musicians are out to impress everybody. And I think what happens as you grow and mature, you're like, okay, you know, whatever. There's always gonna be a higher singer or a faster player. I just want to write a good song, you know, and the songwriting process starts to take precedence. And so yeah, but you know, the interesting thing back then, we were playing clubs. Like we would drive down to Detroit all the time. We were playing nightclubs and trying to get in. I mean, it wasn't too bad. We weren't paying to play, but yeah, you weren't getting much. And we were dragging a bunch of gear down there. My brother had these huge bass amp with homemade speakers and all these different speakers we'd carry in and everything. Everybody was so loud, and I'd lose my voice partway, you know, halfway through the set just about because it's so loud you could never hear yourself. And you know, it's just it, and back then the record label was just controlled like everything. So that was, you just got it. You want to get on a record label. Everybody was trying to get a record label, you know, where
Sure.
nowadays, like anybody can put out an album and, you know,
Yeah.
publish it tomorrow. So yeah, it was just a totally different day back then. And it was just weird timing for me too, because like I said, I was just entering college. And so I was in a Harlot throughout college, and we did like another demo in 1990. And then we played and played for a couple of years. I graduated in 91, and then just, you know, the scene changed a lot. I remember when I graduated, I had hair down to my waist, and I graduated from the business school at the University of Michigan. And I remember asking my profs, hey, are there any companies, you know, hiring long-haired dudes? And they just looked at me like I was out of my mind, you know. Nowadays you could get away with it, I'm sure. But back then it was like there was IBM and it was blue suits and whatever. And so yeah, So I came back and worked in the family business so that I could keep doing the band thing. But the problem was, is 91, you guys all know that,
Sure.
you know, all the scene got changed and wiped out and stuff. So we kind of kept doing stuff and end up putting out another, we wrote another album, but we ended up putting it out under a band name called Pulley Teeth. Like, so Harlot basically dissolved. And by about 95, 96, my brother and I split ways because he wanted to do something that sounded like Pantera and I couldn't sing like that. So by 96, I started taking guitar lessons in 96. I had taken piano lessons when I was younger. I started taking guitar lessons in 96, and then I really didn't do anything till around 2004 when I got in Burning Star.
Yeah.
I do have a question about that Harlot, and you could maybe educate me a little bit. I'm a really big indie CD and cassette collector of that time, the late 80s. What differentiated, like, most of the bands put out cassettes. Now, you guys put out a ProPressed CD. What differentiated the guys that were only able to put out cassettes as opposed to the guys that put out the Pro Press silver press CDs?
I don't know if it was timing or what. You know, believe it or not, I don't know if you've ever heard of them. There's a company called Disc Makers that's still around to this
Yes, they're
day.
still around to this day.
Yeah, they're still around to this day. They do it right. And they were the one I went to. And you know what's funny? I just threw away one of the original boxes that, like, the cassettes or CDs or something came in. And I remember how UPS used to do COD, where they deliver it, you have to pay them to get the pay them the freight. And I mean, like, literally the tag had like $8.35 on it or something like that. It was like some insane thing to ship me a box. I mean, nowadays it'd be, you know, way
Yeah.
more than that. And so what happened is, when we went to print them up, I think maybe the difference was, it was just came down to money. How much money you wanted to spend on it. When
Yeah.
we did it, we thought for sure cassettes would sell better, but we thought, man, nope, not too many people are doing CDs. So we kind of went the extra mile, and everybody chipped in a little bit extra money, and we printed CDs also. So the original CD pressing was like was 500, and I hadn't sold them all. And then in about the middle 90s, I was it's part of the reason it got out there, especially worldwide, is there was a distributor guy, and I can't remember his name. I could look it up in my old briefcase, but he contacted me because I was trying to sell him my Pulling Teeth stuff. And he's like, "Well, actually, you know what? I'm kind of more interested in your Harlot. Can you sell me like 10 or 20 or whatever that I'm going to send to my distributors?" And then he's like, "Okay." And so I ended up, and then he came back and wanted to buy more. And I sent him some. It was 50 or 100, because I had some left of the original 500. I didn't sell them all. And I had some left, and I sent him a reasonably significant number of them, and then he screwed me, never paid me. He ghosted me. And so, but the thing is, what happened is, he sold them out to Japan, to Europe, and
Oh,
wherever
that has
have
to be PJ.
you. Yeah.
Was the
So
guy's
what
name
the
PJ?
I'd have to look it up. I don't
Yeah.
remember. But he screwed me royally. Like, he took all those CDs from me, just never gave me a penny. He just ghosted me. He just would never respond to calls or email. Well, it wasn't even emails back then. But anyway, the funny thing is, I mean, you know, that's kind of how it got out. Because other than that, they were mostly just sold, you know, in Michigan area.
Well,
So,
that's when the whole independent CD thing blew up with eBay in the middle 90s.
oh
All these independent CDs of the hair bands.
yeah, it was funny because I would see him. You know what? I kind of liken it to like gold miners. You know, like the reality is, there's only so many albums that were released in the 80s. So I guess, like, to me, I can't imagine paying $120 or something for that album, but I've seen it on eBay selling for that much, and it's
Oh,
rare.
yeah. I mean that's not even a lot for some of these independent CDs from that era. So how did you get involved with Jack Starr? How did that come about?
You know what happened is, I think finally about 2000 or so, I was starting to get, like, I was like, man, you know, I was pretty established at work and starting to feel like I had, you know, the itch to maybe do something again. And there were a couple bands that would put stuff out, and I can't really, like Fifth Angel and just stuff like that. Hey, we're looking for a singer. And I would drop a CD here and there. I can't even remember who all it was. And I think one of them actually was DGM, is a European band. I think they're called DGM. I did something for them, but, you know, didn't end up doing anything with them because I'm from US and they're from Europe. But my brother Rick, he he was the one who introduced me to Manowar years ago, and I remember he always watched listened to Blabbermouth or read Blabbermouth or whatever, and there was a posting, Jack Starr, formerly of Virgin Steel, is going to put out an album on Magic Circle Music, which is owned by members of Manowar. And we were always big fans of Manowar. My brother Rick said, li literally, like when he emailed to me, he's like, "Look, if there's anybody that can appreciate your style of singing, it's this guy or these guys or whatever." And coincidentally, my brother Rick he was part owner with another guy of a record store called Heavy Metal Unlimited. And I remember way back in 1984, I was looking for an album to buy or something, and my brother Rick says, "Hey, you should buy this cassette." And I'm looking at it, I'm like, "Are you serious? Like, it's this dude wearing a fedora, And I'm like, "Oh, come on." And he's like, "Yeah, but Rhett Foerster is singing, so I'm sure it's pretty good." Ended up being Out of Darkness, Jack Starr's solo album. So, I mean, I never listened to Burning Star, actually. I saw their album covers in my brother's store, but I don't know, I never really listened to them. And there's a lot of bands I never didn't listen to, obviously you can't listen to them all, but even I did have that solo album and I really, really liked it. And so in that regard, I thought it was kind of funny too, that 20 years later, I got in the band.
Right, we were
Yeah,
thinking
involved
about
in
that
the
whole
band.
that Riot family sort of tree in a way.
Yeah, so I took like some CDs of recordings and things that I did. I mailed it into Magic Circle Music. And then one day I was just sitting there, and Janine, I think is her name, called me, and she was like, "Hey, I'm calling on behalf of Joey DeMeo. He wants to schedule a call with you." That's the way he always worked. He would schedule a call, which makes sense. Why waste your time calling yourself? And so we scheduled a call. I remember it was like Memorial Day weekend, 2004. And I remember I was actually in this area here speaking on the phone, and I remember being kind of blown away, because all in my mind I was thinking, "Holy shit, I'm talking to Joey DeMeo from Manowar," because I'd been a Manowar fan for many years. And so basically the way it went down is there was a guy named Manuel Aruda, I think is his last name, who I believe still works for Magic Circle Music, and works for Joey. He's like his manager or something. And he liked it, and so he gave it to Joey and said, "Hey, you should listen to this." And Joey listened to it, and he really liked it. And I guess Jack, and I always say this, but Jack and Ned from Burning Star had settled on another singer, and I'm totally forgetting his name, but he was in an Iron Maiden tribute band, and I think part of the reason Joey didn't like him is Joey's not a big fan of Iron Maiden. So I don't know if there's a rivalry thing. I don't know what it is, but in any event, Joey liked me. I remember him specifically. The quote he said that I was a diamond in the rough or whatever. And he thought that my voice would sound great on it. So he ended up telling Jack, because he was producing it, said, "Now you want to use this singer." So they flew me to the, I flew to their studio. I actually used some frequent flyer miles from flying Delta a lot, and flew to their studio. And I just told him, I said, "Man, if I come there, can I meet Eric? Because like he's been my favorite singer forever." And so that's one of my blow your mind life experiences. I was at their studio recording Day of the Reaper, and hitting some screams and stuff. And literally, Eric Adams is on the other side, because they had studio, the booth, and all that jazz. And Eric's sitting on the other side in a chair, listening to me, and Bobbin's had a little bit, listening to me sing, and then talk to me a bit afterwards. I mean, that was just like, no pressure there,
That's cool.
So yeah, after so at the end of that visit, I told Joey, I said, "Hey, like what, when do you think you'll know or whatever?" And he goes, "Oh no, yeah, you're in." So I was like, "Oh, okay." The odd part is it took like a long time to get it going. And the interesting thing, Joey at the time was like, "Look, go home, buy Pro Tools, start working on demos and recording them. We'll bring you back to the studio to record the stuff, but you can work on demos with Pro Tools." And I'm like, "Pro Tools? What?" So I mean, interesting is I learned a lot about, the recording software and all that jazz. And I actually went back and finished all the demos within a few months, and sent them back to Joey with track explanations and everything. But there was this major delay, and I guess Jack got sidetracked on a different country band or something. So that was part of the reason for the delay, because it wasn't until like 2008 that I went back and recorded the vocals, and then it didn't get released till 2009. So yeah, it took forever. But that's what got me going. That was my first performance in Europe, in Magic Circle festival in 2008, and then again in 2009. That ended up being kind of how I got in. Everything just kind of rolled from there because Land of the Dead, Jack got away from Magic Circle Music, so the second album, Land of the Dead, were released on, I think it was on Limb, and that was produced by Bart Gabriel. And Bart Gabriel is from Poland, and he produced it, so he had ended up lining up a few shows for us. So in 2013, we went to go play at the Keep It True Festival. Bernie Starr did, and then we had two shows in Greece and one in Italy. And after that little run of four shows, when I came back home, Bart emailed me and said, Riot's looking for a singer, and that's how I ended up getting connected to Donnie, and I sent Donnie some. To get in Riot, my audition was I recorded vocals on some songs off of Immortal Soul. And I remember Donnie ended up later on, he ended up posting one of the songs, and people were like, yeah, apparently I sounded enough like Tony that some people didn't even know who it was. And so Donnie was kind of teasing, hey, we got this new singer going, and they weren't telling anybody who it was. Although I think there were some people that guessed. There were some people that knew my voice well enough that they guessed, which I'm weird like that. I feel like I know my voice well, but at the same time, I don't have like a, I don't think I have an incredibly unique sounding tone, and not like Tony Harnell or somebody like that, who's just like you. Wow, you just really know who that is.
Now, before we go too deep into Riot, I did want to touch a little bit on a band called Reverence, a band
Yeah.
that I really liked a lot. I thought the first album was phenomenal. How did that come together, and how did you get Steve, Dr. Killdrums, involved with that?
Well, so basically, with Jack's band, and this isn't a slam on Jack, he's down in Florida. He and Ned, they tend to work on the music, and they're creative guys, and they tend to work. So in that band, I didn't really have a lot of creative input. I would write lyrics, but a lot of times the lyrics, like melodies, are already made up. I'm pretty much just making up some lyrics for the melodies they have. And then I wasn't that busy. It takes them a long time to do stuff. And so I got approached. Oh, actually, that the guy who was the studio engineer, Dirk Kloiber, and he was kind of the engineer for a few Manowar albums and all that. He worked at their studio. He and I got talking. He's like, "Yeah, I got a couple demos. Send me some stuff." And so I recorded like three songs with him, and I had posted one of them to MySpace or something. I think it was MySpace ago. And this fella named Brian Holland stumbled across that. My page and that song, and he there was a song in particular called Phantom Road that he really liked, and so I don't know if you know that, but that song off that the first Reverence album was written by Dirk, me and Dirk Kloiber. So that was a wasn't that's the one oddball song on there, but Brian Holland liked it so much he wanted to include it on the album. And so what happened when Brian first approached me, he had been playing with oh my God, I'm totally forgetting the name. Black Hearts and Jaded Spades was the name of their album, Tokyo Blade.
Tokyo Blade.
He'd been playing, so he kind of was instrumental in resurrecting Tokyo Blade. He found the guitar player, and forgive me, I can't
Andy
remember his name.
Bolton.
Yes, he found him and kind of brought him back and got everything back together, and they were playing shows and doing stuff together, and somehow they had like a split of some sort, but Brian kind of owned the Tokyo Blade name or something. And so he came to me and was like, hey, do you want to do something? I got this Tokyo Blade thing going, da, 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 da. And I looked at him, and I'm like, well, I wasn't interested in doing it if it was Tokyo Blade. And then, I don't know, a couple weeks later, Brian came back to me and said, let's just write some music together, and we won't worry about calling it Tokyo Blade. And we did, and that eventually became Reverence. As far as the connection with Doc, Brian knew him, and there was a connection because Brian was a huge Sabotage fan, and also Brian had done website work and stuff like that. So somehow there was some connection there, and he and Doc were, friendly and real friendly with, knew each other and had hung out and stuff like that. So that's how Doc got involved on the album. And but yeah, Brian and I just, kind of bear down. He ended up getting this Pete Rossi, who was an awesome guitar player, involved too. So Pete ended up coming in later on and put his mark on a lot of stuff, especially with solos and that. But really, basically, the bulk of the music, the music was written by Brian, really, and I wrote all the lyrics and vocal melodies. So it, it opened the door for me to have a lot more creative input into it. And I'm with you, man. I really loved that first album, and I thought the second album was great. I was like, man, this is gonna sound stupid, but after that, I was just like, Jesus, I don't know what more I can do. Like, I mean, how? You know what I mean? I felt like it was catchy, and everything. And my singing style is a little bit different. I call it, it's a little bit, I tried to rasp it up a little bit, but I'm not
A
particularly
little
good.
more like power metal, like the European power metal sound.
And so I don't know, man, I liked it, and I have a lot of great memories from that. We did play some shows in Europe after that album. And but I had just joined, I just joined Riot, told the guys, and we had this whole second album written, and we kind of were falling apart. And do we release it? And I told Brian, well, we'd be dumb not to release it. I mean, we got it all written, so that so we ended up doing Gods of War and doing that album as
Well,
well.
it
And then,
seemed to lose momentum because when the first one came out, it came out in 2012, which was kind of like the first year that the new wave of traditional heavy metal stuff really started to come to life with a lot of the bands that, I mean, it's become a whole movement now. But that was really like the first year, 2012, 2011, 2012. And I remember when it came out, it had a lot of buzz, the first album. I know, amongst my friends and, guys I keep up with and it looked like, and that whole movement was kind of taking off. And
And and we worked hard too. We played some shows. I remember playing show in Pittsburgh and Baltimore and doing some different stuff, and we did some shows in Europe. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to get attention in the music business. It's hard to make a splash. And so what happened is, I think by the time the second album was coming out, I had already told the guys, like, because I was in Burning Star and Reverence and in Riot, and all of a sudden Riot started. I didn't realize it when I got in Riot. I figured it'd be like Burning Star, where like once every 2 years I'd have a show or two, and all of a sudden Riot comes out and it's like, you got to play. And it was like, okay, in my situation, especially back then, my one daughter was born in 2010, so she was only 3, 4 years old or whatever, 5 years old. And my other kids were older than that, but it was just too hard to tell my wife, like, hey, you know how I'm gone 6 weeks a year with Riot? Well, like, I'm going to be gone with Reverence now too. And maybe bring, it just, it reached, yeah, the situation was just, it got untenable. And so I had to, I just had to tell both bands, like, look, I can't perform live with you anymore. And that really hurt the guys in Reverence. It took them a little while to forgive me for that one. Pete Rossi was particularly mad. Doc wasn't mad at me about it. He and I are still on good terms, and Brian and I are still on good terms too. But Pete was not very happy with me.
Did Steve play with you guys when you played live?
No, no,
Yeah, he
no,
was
no.
just strictly studio.
No, when we toured, the drummer was a guy named Lorenzo Gonzalez. And even Steve, it was hard for him to do all the studio stuff. So like on that first album, it was like half the songs were Steve and half the songs were Tony Rossi, Pete Rossi's brother. So, but yeah, Steve's, I know right where he's at, man. He's got a busy life, and he's got his own business and stuff going on, and his other hobbies, and like he loves music, and so you always have that desire, that itch to play, but it can be hard to find, it can be hard to make space for it,
Because we had one of the members on from Crimson Glory. He did an album with them, and it was kind of the similar thing. Like when I started picking his brain, it was like he didn't play on all. He played on some of the album, but he didn't really play on all of it. But we credited him for all of it. Didn't do the tour, so it was like I think people like wanted that name. The name is very recognizable, and the name has got some oomph to it. Like when you could put it on your record, but it's
Yeah, that certainly was part of Brian's thinking, and but in a way, it's like, Doc wanted to do it too, I remember when Doc flew up to do the videos, and then I toured him through my factory, and he met my dad, and my dad's a big car guy, and my dad's, very mechanically inclined. I remember Doc went back and he mailed my dad a shirt that says I weld, you know, and stuff like that. And so, I mean, we actually felt really, really close, from that, because, we shot videos for the first and the second album together. So he came up to visit me a couple times. So.
No, I mean, just to hang with metal royalty is a privilege unto itself.
Yeah,
Now,
exactly.
did you grow up a Riot fan, or like, is it something that you kind of just found yourself in because of your vocal style being v very similar to Toni Moore?
Well, I mean, for me, like I didn't follow a lot of Riot. I knew what happened is when I was 13 or whatever, quite young, my brother John's band used to play Swords and Tequila. And so I remember sitting along in the basement and singing along with Swords and Tequila from way back when, in 81 or whatever. I would have been like 11, 12 years old. So I remember that song then. I also remember my brother telling me that, that Restless Breed was one of his favorite albums. So I remember hearing those songs. And I do specifically remember my brother buying the Thundersteel album. And like the way our basement was set up, there was like a room on either side of the steps that went down the middle. And a lot of times the steps were like your chair. So you'd sit on the steps and, and I specifically remember sitting on the steps and looking over the railing at my brother jamming Thundersteel and just thinking, my God, listen to that guy sing. It sounds like he's on helium, Who the hell can sing that, But I think by then, already having the Harlot stuff going, how do you word it? I don't know. It start, when you're young and dumb, it's like maybe more competitive. So I didn't allow myself to really listen to it as much and enjoy it as much then, as I later came to appreciate it. And then after that, I knew that one and I knew Privilege of Power because my brother had that one too. But after that, I lost track. I was unaware of Mike DeMeo. I didn't know his albums at all, really.
I mean, it was kind of easy to lose track with that band because there's so many. We talked about the tree. It's like there's so many branches on that one.
Yeah, there's a lot. But what's funny is there are people that are like staunch Mike DeMeo fans. Like that's when they met, that's how they met the band, especially
Absolutely.
in Europe. And they're like, man, Mike's the guy, man, he's the best singer. I can't
Yep.
stand him. I know this, I had this woman over in Slovenia telling me that. She was like, nope, man, I don't even like the original Riot. She's like, I don't even like those songs. I love the DeMeo stuff and you. And we don't play a lot of the demand stuff, so
No, I have a
so
very close friend of mine, and we grew up on Riot from basically from the early 80s. He thinks DeMeo is the best singer that was ever in the band. And
yeah.
And oddly enough, DeMeo plays in a very good friend of mine's cover band, plays in an
Oh
Allman Brothers cover band. He has a gig with Tommy James. He plays with
yeah.
Tommy James. That's his
Yeah.
main gig. But
Yeah,
he
that's
plays
his
with
main
my,
thing.
he lives in Long Island, and he plays in my friend's Allman Brothers Grateful Dead tribute band. He plays keyboards and sings.
Yeah, we just did an out we did a Keep It True show, and it was a special kind of show, 50th anniversary kind of thing or for whatever you want to call it. And so because Riot was technically formed in 75, and yeah, we tried getting Mike DeMeo to go, we tried getting Toni Moore to go, and they just they wouldn't go. It was like really bummer. I approached Toni Moore personally. I've never met him in person, but we've exchanged messages and stuff before. And I've invited him out. Every time we go to LA, I'll invite him out. And I really want him to show up. I'm like, dude, you can do whatever. I'm like, you can have the stage all to yourself. I'll stand up there and sing with you. I'll do backups. I'll do whatever. Just come on out. I would say the same to Mike DeMeo. Although I'm not on speaking terms with Mike DeMeo, not like we're not. Not speaking terms, but I've never met him. I've never known him. I've never talked to him. My understanding with Mike DeMeo is he was more, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. He could speak for himself, but my understanding from the guys is that basically once Mark died, he was like, no Mark, no Riot. And that
Yeah,
was
that's
basically.
true because I know it from I mean I've been at shows when he's been there. I've never really spoke to him in depth about it, but I through my friend, he would tell me the same thing. You know, my friend doesn't even know much about Riot, but he had told me like whoever the guy was in the band when he died, he didn't want no part of it anymore.
And I would say, like, for me, I would, I really wanted Mike to go to the anniversary show too. I thought, like, what the heck, I mean, but yeah, and I could see where, Mike has more of what I call, I don't know, a lot of people will throw a Whitesnake or whatever, but he's got more of a bluesy
Oh yeah,
David
absolutely.
kind
Absolutely.
of thing going. And, so I can see where, yeah, I mean, I think he stands out because his rasp is different. Like Rhett Foerster has a fair amount of rasp too, but just different. Yeah, different. So, I mean, I could see it. But to me, it all comes down to, I mean, just think about it. When there's an album that you absolutely love, like that's, like for me, you pick whatever band, but I mean, like if Iron Maiden Peace of Mind was the first one you ever liked, well, then if you hear the stuff with Paul Di'Anno on it, you're probably like, what's that? I
Right,
mean, and vice
sure.
versa, that's just the way it works. It's kind of hard to hear someone else doing it. Which is why I feel pretty blessed in Riot. Fortunately, I guess it's a good thing I'm the fifth singer because they've had so many similar people, But
Yeah.
there's some people that are like, ah, I can't stand that guy, whatever, So fortunately, for the most part, because I'm one of those idiots that read comments, I mean, generally speaking, the comments are pretty positive in
Oh,
regard to
yeah.
me. I don't need anybody to tell me I'm their favorite. I don't care as long as you like it and you go to the shows or whatever.
Yeah.
Our albums, I mean, that's, It's all
Well,
it matters.
we had Tony on the show last year. He's just moved on from the whole scene. He moved out to LA. He's into a whole different trip of music. And
Well, he was.
he spoke glowingly about you too. So I mean, it's nothing, about you that he doesn't want. He just does. He's just not into it anymore. He's,
Yeah, he's always been very friendly to me. I mean, the guys told me that originally he was like in a jazz band or
He
something. He
was,
played
yeah.
bass in a jazz band,
He's a
and they found
tremendous,
him.
I mean, like a virtuoso bass player. Yeah.
Exactly.
A very,
And
really,
so,
really super talented guy.
but he just
And
happened to have this really high voice doing all these backup vocals. So
yeah.
Donnie told me they, back in the day that they, and I don't know if this is an embellishment, but like they bought Judas Priest and Van Halen and whatever and things and said, hey, be more like this guy or whatever. And so it's like they kind of tried to make him into, the kind of metal thing. And yeah, and I think that's not really his thing. And that's what he tells me now is just like, vocally speaking, it's just like for him to, he's like, man, to get into that again. But I honestly, you never know. I don't know. It's been a while, Immortal Soul, what, 2012. So I mean, it's,
Well, I could
and
tell you,
then.
I saw them on the Immortal Soul tour in New York, and I guess he was I probably like in his later 40s at the time.
Oh,
He
he would have been
sang,
well into his later 40s. Yeah,
right.
yeah.
He sang that stuff note for note. I mean, it was incredible. I was right in the front of the stage. I could not believe how this guy sang everything, like no fudging it, no
Yeah,
downtuning.
you should look it up because I'm telling you, it wasn't that long. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to overage him, but man, I wouldn't be surprised if he's pushing 70 now because I remember it was quite a while ago
Well,
when I
he's
talked to
similar. I'm 66. He's similar age to me. So
him.
yeah.
Because I remember it was a while ago that somebody, he was like, yeah, well, I'm 60 already. And that was a few years ago,
Yeah, he might be a year
But
older than me. He's close in age to me. So yeah. I mean,
yeah.
at this stage of the game, to ask him to do that stuff might be a push, but
Yeah, and I don't know. There's some singers, like I look at Biff Bifford, from Saxon, and we just played with them in San Antonio. It was an awesome show in a theater. My God, the place was packed. It was just such a beautiful theater. I felt like $1 million getting to open up for them. It was so awesome. It was Lizzie Borden and then us and then Saxon
Wow.
and man alive, I mean the place was full and people were just so nice and my God, it was just I don't know. When you're in this theater and you look, I mean the above the stage, I think that ceiling was like 90 feet tall because they could take our backdrop was like 25 feet tall and they would just move it up and it would just disappear. And it was like just a fun show. And yeah, I mean I got to talk to Biff a little bit afterwards and I don't even know if he knew I was the singer, but he just knew I was some dude complimenting him, I guess. But yeah, he was hitting a lot of high notes and stuff. I was like, wow, so, and I know he's 70, so
Oh yeah, no, I just saw them last year.
amazing.
Same thing. Great. He's great.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've had pretty good luck. I just turned 56. I didn't sing a lot all my life. Like for someone like Biff who's been singing so much, I mean, that's impressive.
But look at a guy like Glenn Hughes too, right?
I mean, like to me, I don't know. I don't, I guess I'll just keep going. I ran into a little bit of trouble in the spring. We had a tour, And I ended up having to basically cancel the last two shows because, I developed laryngitis first time I ever had it. I got sick, but I mean, I got sick as in like lights out sick. Like I could kind of talk like this, but other than
Oh,
that,
wow.
there was no
Yeah.
vocal coming out, at all. It was just like, guys, because Donnie's like, just get up there. I'm like, dude, there's nothing. Like, I can't sing at all. Like the song I was to, when the sun goes down, that note down, I couldn't even hit that. That was too
Wow.
high.
And that's a low note. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, when the sun goes down, like that was just like,
Right.
oh my God. I'm like, dude, I'm like, this is impossible. So like in Slovenia, we knew this woman who was a singer, and she knew a lot of our songs. So she stepped in, and like, because we were already set up. And I was just trying to rest my voice. I had sang the night before and I was fine, but I knew afterwards I was pretty spent. When I woke up the next morning, my voice was just, I knew I was like, oh boy, this is bad. And I just didn't talk all day, hoping I'd have something when I, and I didn't sing a sound check because I didn't want to risk it. And then it was like an hour before the show, and I'm like, well, I better warm up my voice. And I was warming it, warming it, warming it, and like nothing. And so I went to the promoter and said, look, dude, I'm sorry, but I've got nothing. And people were there, everything, and I'm just like, and so we ended up doing a show where I, this woman, and then there were two other guys that sang a song. But this woman, Kate Leather is her name. She ended up singing like 10 songs or more.
Really?
And I was up on stage too, just monkeying around, dancing around like a monkey, and trying to say and sing a couple of things. And so we pulled that off. But then the next show, I had to cancel because I just had no voice,
Wow.
like at all. And that, like I said, that's the first time it's ever happened to me. I've been sick before. Like we toured South America the year before, and I got really sick. I mean, I was in Colombia and just sick as a dog, and I got a steroid. I'm not proud of it, but I just to get the inflammation or whatever go down, I got a steroid shot in my ass just to try to get by, and I was able to fudge it through the last two shows and get home. But it's scary stuff, boy. When you get sick, it's lights out, because
And
I
when you're
don't.
not home, it's even worse. You're
Yeah.
far
Oh, yeah.
from home, and you don't.
Oh, yeah.
How
And
I
when you're a
wanted to
singer
ask you
too,
too, like
right?
how I know you're into training. I've been into training my whole life. How challenging is it for you when you do go on the road or go to South America or Japan to keep yourself feeling 100% or 90% every day?
Well, there's really two aspects. The physical side, I mean, obviously I weight train. I don't go nuts, but like 3 times a week. Sometimes if we're gone for a longer tour, I take stretch bands and stuff like that because I want to be able to do something. But I walk every day too. I do like 10,000 steps a day. So I do that all the time, no matter where I'm at, which, in Colombia, I remember the lady's like, well, don't go that far. It's
Yeah,
like,
right.
okay.
Walking circles.
So sometimes I loop the block, So I do that stuff. I'm not a big drinker. I really love a beer, and I love nice flavorful beers, but I don't drink a lot of beer. So I'll have like one or two maybe after the show. That's kind of a reward for me. But otherwise, like when I'm just at home, I don't drink much of anything. A six pack will last me months, And so I try to eat healthy too. When I'm on the road, my rule of thumb is I want to find as many fruits and vegetables as I can, because meat is like, and potatoes or whatever is always around, it seems. So I just try to eat healthy that way, and I try to get sleep. Sleep's the killer. Some of these tours, they don't realize that they put you on these tours and they throw you in a plane the next morning, and you get 3 hours of sleep at night. And they
That's
always
the
say, well,
thing.
you can make it up in the afternoon, and it's you can't. Ben, I read an art, and I think it explained it, because like I read an article and it said like your immune system crashes by like 50 or 70% or something if you don't get that much sleep. If you only get like 2, 3 hours of sleep. And it makes total sense to me, because that's exactly what happens. We do this, and then we get run down, and then we're all sick. And that's just a killer. I would say, like, for me, it really comes down to, I'm not, I know sometimes people say, oh, he's a powerful singer. And I mean, okay, I can be loud, on notes, but, and when I'm recording in the studio, I'll be louder because I maybe want to get whatever. But, when it comes to singing live, you really have to do what I would call the best facsimile of it you can. That's not, and like, I don't like to pull any notes. I like to try to hit every note that's on the album, whatever I can, But you also I rock climb also. And so in rock climbing, one of the things I'll tell you is that if you to rock climb, you basically want to hold onto the rock as lightly as you can and still stay on the rock, you know? And so, because if you grip tight, you pump your arms out.
Right.
And vocal with vo it's very similar with vocals. You want to sing as easy as you possibly can and as light as you can, just enough to get the note out and have it be supportive. Because if like this talking I'm doing right now is more dangerous and more damaging to my throat than actually singing if I'm doing it properly. Just because, when you talk, you tend to use your throat to talk rather than put the notes up in your head. And so yeah, to me, it all comes down to, the in-ear monitors and staying comfortable and not getting too out of gas, running around. Sometimes I'll get it when we're on big stages, because I like to move around a bit and I'll get a little gassed. There are some songs that are harder than others because like the way the chorus is, like the call and response and all that. And I only have Mike to help me with backup, so I feel like I have to sing. Well, Donnie does a little bit, but I feel like I have to sing a lot. So I think other than that, man, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if there's a magic science to it other than then I also I don't talk. Like after the shows, people probably think I'm really weird, but when they come up to me after the show, like I'll be like going like this and I'll be right in their ear and I'll be talking really quiet. And I don't sit and talk over loud music. I don't like to talk a lot during the day. And I just have to get really conscientious of where I put my voice when I talk too. So other than that, yeah, I don't have any. I'm not like some classically trained. I know all this whatever crap. I kind of winging it, if you know what I mean. So, I will say that, being on the road with Riot, I feel like it's taught me a lot about it. And we've had, I mean, I've had a lot of shows in a row before. Where, like 8 or 9 shows in a row. I've had 8 shows in 9 days. Or the last tour they did, it was 5 shows 1 day, 5 more shows, and stuff like that.
Wow,
That
that's killer.
Well, that wouldn't kill me because I got sick. If I
Right.
wouldn't have got sick, I would have been fine. I was in whatever it was, Italy or something the night before, and I felt like I, sang fine. And it took me it, what's weird for me is like I'll warm up beforehand, but then when I go out to start singing every now and then, you're not feeling warmed up. You feel like it takes you a few songs to get warmed up. And when that happens, it's a little scary for me. What was goofy about that last tour, like I said, I had 5 and 5 shows, is I got through 6 shows and I felt like I was invincible. I was walking out, I felt really warmed up every night, everything was coming out easy, and I don't know what it was. That 7th show, I think my voice was feeling a little itchy or whatever, like maybe something was coming on, and it took me a while to warm up, but I was able to get through that 7th show or whatever. But then all of a sudden it was like the maybe it was a 6 show, whatever. I don't know, but it was like oh, it was 4 and 4. I think it was supposed to be 8 altogether. But in any event, at the end of that show, I could just tell my voice was like really hoarse, and I was like, oh boy, that wasn't good. And like I said, when I woke up the next morning, it was lights out. It was lights out. First time I ever
Do
had
you
lights out.
take more supplements when you're on the road, or do you use a lot of supplements?
I really don't, no, I try to eat fruits and vegetables, stuff like that, to get my vitamins. I take some glucosamine for my joints and L-lysine and stuff like that. But other than that, I don't do a whole lot of supplements. But yeah, so, and sometimes if you got it available, I like ginger and honey and tea and stuff, but we don't usually have it on the rider. I know when I tour, when we did that one tour with Primal Fear, that was kind of fun because they always had ginger and honey and lemon and stuff.
Well,
But
Ralph's a bodybuilder too, so I mean,
although he doesn't work out, though. We were on that tour for the month. I'm like, you gonna work out? Because I remember Mike Flintz and I, we'd be running, we'd leave the bus and we'd run off, find a local park, and we'd be hanging our stretch bands off trees. And I was laughing because I'm like, man, these people around Europe must think we're stupid, because like we'd have our shirts off, and because we didn't want to sweat up all our shirts and stuff, and we'd be in the middle of the park exercising and doing push-ups and doing planks and all this crap with a stretch band. And I remember inviting Ralph, because he and I got pretty close on that. He's a sweetheart of a man,
Yeah,
just
he's a great
really.
guy. Yeah.
And so he and I got pretty close, and we did go for walks a couple times. And I tried talking him into working out. He's like, nope, I want to rest on the tour. So
Yeah, I mean that's
oh
yeah, and he's another guy. His voice is incredible. He's like, I think
yeah.
he's 61. And he still sounds tremendous.
And I will tell you, he is louder than hell. That
Yeah.
guy, if you want to talk about a powerful singer, holy shit. I mean, I
Yeah.
can't, like, I haven't heard Rob Halford, warm up or anything, but I've listened to Ralph warm up, and he's a, like,
He's a beast,
very,
yeah.
and I think part of it is, like, there's a certain tone and stuff he wants, and that's how he knows how to get it out. I remember he walked up to me, and we were sitting there, and we were at the bar at one place, and I think I'd finished our warm up, and they were getting ready to, actually, I think we might have done sound check after them, but whatever. He came up to me, and he's like, "Well, like, how loud are you singing?" And I'm like, "Oh, I don't know. We drank to the sunrise, rode away singing, Johnny's back again." I'm like, "That loud?" He's like, "Really?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, I mean, let the microphone do the work, Because he was like, he'd be warming up. He'd just be, I don't even want to do it right now. I don't want to hurt my throat. But he'd just be like, "Whoa!" But just
Yeah,
like
no,
louder
he's
than that. And I'm just like, all right, But man, I can't, if I sang like that, it wouldn't last long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just too much. It's too much for me. But
Wow. He goes way back into the 80s. He was in a band called Tear and Pace
oh,
before. Yeah.
yeah. I remember there were some old videos of him, like in Germany and all,
Yeah,
and
Tear and Pace. That was
TV
his
and stuff.
first big band. And
Yeah. That's
he
crazy.
then he was in the band. He was in Gamma Ray with
Yep.
with the guy from
Yep.
Helloween. That's what really put him on the map. That's like when everybody like knew who he was.
Yeah,
But
they're out touring right now. I Matt Sinner, he sent me a birthday message on Facebook, and he said, "Oh, happy birthday." And I said, "Oh man, I hope your tour is going great." And he's like, "Yeah, it's the best tour yet, or something like that." I'm like,
yeah,
"Man, I
no,
wish you."
Matt thankfully has really bounced back from his health issues, and he looks great and he's playing great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I told him, I'm like, "Man, I wish we could get up with you guys again, So, and he said, "Yeah, me too." So yeah, real nice guy. I was very yeah, well, it was great. That was great. That was a bucket list item for me. I've never all this time with Riot, we're not really in tour buses. We're usually shuttle buses flying between shows, stuff like that. Because tour buses are expensive,
Yeah, if you
And
can even
when
find
we
them nowadays, right?
Yeah, when we did the tour in 2018 with Primal Fear, it was 25 shows, 30 days, and that was part of the deal. Like, frankly, I don't even remember if we got paid really. I think we were supposed to just try to get paid off of merch, but what they did is they allowed us to be on the tour bus, and they let us have their techs and their stuff, their equipment. I mean, it was a sweetheart of a deal for them. So we got to use our drums. Our drummer Frank just was not supposed to change anything except maybe the pedals or something. And we got to use their amps and all their tech people and everything. Although it's pretty easy, really, because if it's the same drums and stuff, it's not like they're setting up two
Right.
drum sets. And then, yeah, we were all of us on a tour bus, with 16 people up on the top of the tour bus. It's like a
Wow.
double decker bus. And Ralph's bed was, they let me have the, because the back is more noisy, the engine. So they let me have, like, in the front, there was a little lounge way in the front of the top. But behind it were all the beds that were all stacked up. And I remember them saying, yeah, this is your spot. So Ralph was right above me and I was right below. And I think Matt was across from me and stuff. So yeah, it was crazy. It was like a little coffin. I was paranoid. Like, seriously, like, if you're like this and you
Yeah.
rolled over like that, your elbow hits the, and
Wow.
like, if you sit up and stuff, it's a little freaky. And I was worried, like, I was, man, I don't know if I'll be able to sleep or whatever have you. And so I took melatonin and I took Dramamine, because I can get motion sickness. I didn't want to risk that. And both of those tend to obviously knock you out.
Right.
And so my routine, I actually ended up being absolutely beautiful. I mean, I just loved it, because my routine was I would hang out in the club until, so we would play. After Primal Fear finished, they would vacate everything. So I'd run in and take my shower and get all ready and everything. And then I'd just sit and hang out in the dressing room. Usually we had a separate dressing room from them. But sometime the shower was shared. And I'd hang out in the dressing room until the night was closed, and everybody, they're like, "All right, you got to get on the tour bus." And usually that was going to be about 2 o'clock in the morning. So 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd go get on the tour bus. I'd take my melatonin and my Dramamine or whatever, and I would lay down, and man, I would zone. Well, I also wear earplugs. I would wear wax earplugs so I wouldn't hear too much noise, and I would just zone out. I'd wake up like 10, 11 o'clock, whatever, the next day, and then we'd be at the new place, and then I could just stroll off the bus and go in and
That's
have a
great.
little
Yeah.
breakfast, lunch. And so I was getting, 8, 9 hours of sleep every night. It was like literally humming me to sleep. It was like, you know what I mean? It was like a baby in a cradle or whatever. And
Right.
that, so I it really worked for me. I'd love to do that more, but like I said, buses are way too expensive.
Yeah.
We
What?
actually, I think Primal Fear, there was an opportunity for us to potentially go with Primal Fear again. I think this latest set of tours, but it's just too hard, you know, to, because everybody's scrounging to try to make money, and I don't think they could afford that whole deal where they take the tour bus and we get to be on it or whatever have you and all that. I don't know, but that wasn't what was offered again this time, and we're like, well, we can't do that. We're
Yeah, well, they kind of took a break in between albums. They hadn't put out an album in a couple of years, and I think Matt's health had something to do with that. And yeah,
Well,
I
they put out one during COVID. They put out one. They put out one where he didn't even play shows with them. They had a bass player stand in for quite a few shows.
right. And I think they actually have a female guitar player now.
Yep. Yeah. They switched since we played in the band. Yeah, Ralph and Matt are the only two guys in the band. The drummer that was in the band when we toured with him, he wasn't even in it for the next album. And then the two guitar players, Alex and Tom, they
They're
left for
gone.
the.
Yeah. And Magnus is back now with them again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's they're pretty productive though. They keep putting out albums. They put out albums a lot faster than Riot does. That's pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, where are we at with Riot 5? Because 2024 Mean Streets comes out. Anything in the on the horizon?
You know, we're in the midst of about a 9 month break right now. We finished our last shows in July. We don't have anything, I don't think, until May. And so, yeah, we're supposed to be writing songs right now. Donnie told me he's got two, he thinks, reasonably in the can, so to speak, and he's working on a third. I haven't heard anything from Mike lately. Mike keeps himself busier than a cat burying shit 5 miles from dirt. I mean, this guy, he is just running around constantly. He plays in a Bee Gees tribute band. He plays in a Neil Diamond tribute band. He plays in wedding band. He does stuff with his wife, just the two of them. And he also owns a guitar school where he teaches guitar lessons. This guy travels like he's in planes all the time. He's always running around. So I don't know how the hell he'd find time to write a song, but he needs to, because it's always a competition between him and Donnie. He doesn't want Donnie to write all the songs, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping somebody gets on it, but nobody's shown me anything. Usually Mike definitely shows me his stuff because I usually write lyrics for Mike's stuff. Donnie, it's kind of half and half. I sometimes write lyrics, I sometimes don't. So.
I wanted to ask you now that the three albums that came out, they're kind of stylistically like very much in the Thundersteel vein. Now, obviously, there's two members from the Thundersteel lineup that are in the band. Would you guys ever move off of that somewhat and kind of do some stuff that's more in the, say, Speranza or Red Forester? More
Well,
style.
if you look at this album, we specifically tried to have more diversity in it. So if you look at and I'm forgetting the names of the songs, but
Well, there's a lot of nods to different eras. I did pick up on that. Yeah.
like Love Beyond the Grave, that's basically a Rhett Forester type of riff right there,
Yes, it
although
is. Yes.
it doesn't sound like it. And then Lean Into It, that was definitely like an Overdrive basically type song. The reality is I really love the Guy Speranza era. I have trouble deciding which era I love better between Guy Speranza and Tony Mora and
Me too.
between
Those
those
are my
guys.
two favorite eras
Yeah.
too.
And so I'd be totally down with doing something that was, I just don't know. Like, so basically Donnie is, he was a principal writer on Thundersteel.
Yes.
And so he and Mark worked very closely on it. And that was kind of this, Donnie brought that special sauce. You know, Mark was a little chameleon and like what he would do is he knew who he was with. especially singers and stuff like that. And he would start catering stuff toward that, you know? So that's why you see he gets a Rhett Foerster in the band, and all of a sudden the music starts to sound a bit different. And that's because he's catering it more toward what he had. And then obviously, you know, Mike DeMeo was the same deal. And so what happened is, you know, he was always developing himself. And like, I don't want to speak too much, but I mean, the guys tell me a lot of stories. So I don't want to act like I'm an authority on Mark. I've never met the guy. I really, really wish I had, and I'd been on an album, but you know, they tell me enough stories. And, you know, they told me that basically in the 80s, he was always growing. He was always learning. He had a thing where he was getting influenced by, you know, Yngwie Malmsteen and all the other fast guitar players of the day. And not that he would ever try to sound like that, but he was very skilled. And he was reaching the point, and I don't know if because Donnie he kind of hooked up with Donnie like as early as 83 or 84, something like that, because he would winter down in Texas and in San Antonio. And so Donnie got partnered up with him then, because there was some guy who was like a record label associated with the record label, and he was like, hey, Donnie was down there in SA Slayer and doing his different stuff, and apparently the guy came to him and said, hey, you know, Mark Reale is down here, he's looking for guys to jam with. And Donnie was like, are you kidding me? Because like in San Antonio, Riot was pretty big, because there was a DJ that would play him on the radio and that. And so Donnie knew him and loved him, even the Guy Speranza era and stuff. And so he was like, well, hell yeah. And so that's the funny thing. Donnie, he played with Rhett Foerster. He played with
I know.
the drummer guy, who's always slagging us. I can't think of his
Sandy
name.
Slavin, he's a huge fan of you guys.
Yeah, Sandy Craven. He seems to go in and out. Every now and then he's halfway nice, but yeah, in general he's pretty upset. I don't, you know. But anyway, Donnie played. The funny thing is, Sandy O'Slavin would say, who's this Donnie guy? I don't even know who he is. But Donnie actually lived with Sandy Slavin and his wife.
Wow.
So for Sandy to act like he doesn't know him seems a little insane. What, not that I want to get in the middle of all that. I don't really. If Sandy thinks we're illegitimate, that's fine. Anybody thinks Riot's, you know, Riot 5 is illegitimate, you know, just, I guess. You know, I'm sorry, don't listen or whatever. I mean, but in any event, yeah. So what happened is, you know, Mark kind of was evolving and Donnie was helping him get there, because Donnie was more that power metal guy and Mark wanted to move to that. And they were specifically like, yeah, we need to, like the first time, like there's footage of Rhett Foerster singing Sign of the Crimson Storm. And that's, but Rhett Foerster little, and Donnie can do his like little accent or whatever. He's like, hey, you fellas, you know. Yeah, that's not my bag, but good luck to you and all that stuff like that. Because like he would hear Thundersteel and stuff, and he was just like, yeah, that's not my thing, and it isn't his thing. And so that's how they got something going. And actually, some of the original members, Donnie found the drummers and stuff. Donnie was like, he'd go through his album collection. Oh, this guy's good, he, you know. And that's how he found different people to be in the band and with them and stuff. And so yeah, I mean, but Donnie was pretty instrumental in writing and working with Mark to write most of the songs on Thundersteel, and so and on Privilege of Power. So consequently, you know, that's his bailiwick, I guess you'd say. So for him, when he's in Riot, that's why really I think it. And like Mike is, you know how you have people in the band that are the driver? Well, maybe you don't, but I mean, you have people that are the driver of the band, and then the people that are, I don't know, they're a little more along for the ride or whatever, you know. And Mike's a little more like that. Like he doesn't want the hassle of managing and trying to figure everything out and do this and that, you know. Like, hey man, I'll write songs and I'll show up and I'll play the gigs, but like, you know. And but Donnie's all over it. He's like the manager and he's the guy and he's the this and that. And I'm not saying anything bad about Mike or whatever. I'm just saying that's just the dynamic. And so because of that, Donnie kind of really drives the way the band sounds, I guess you'd say. But
Makes sense.
I can tell Mike's songs. Mike's songs tend to, I don't know how you call it, have a little more of a gothic element. They tend to lean more to what I would call the Mike DeMeo era, a lot of Mike's songs. So I guess, man, sorry, I talk way too long and I probably gave you the longest answer in the world. I don't know if this group is capable of writing something that would sound like the original era Riot. I don't know. Maybe, and Donnie would probably think I'm insulted and say that. I just don't know. Because even if I listen to Lean Into It, it doesn't, it's got hints of it, but it doesn't sound just
Hence,
like
yeah.
it. Yeah. So I don't know how to recapture that one, but I love Guy Speranza's voice. You know, it's you know, I don't think he's, you know, like I think Tony maybe, I don't know who wrote the melodies, but the albums with Tony's probably have more interesting melodies or more varied melodies, I guess you'd say.
Well,
In
Guy
some
was very
cases,
unique. Guy was unique. Nobody sounded like him. Nobody
yeah, his
sounded like him
tone.
then. Nobody sounds like him now. There's never been anybody that sounded like him. So that alone gives you a lot of credibility when nobody could
Exactly.
copy. You don't have to be particularly great. If you have that identifiable sound and nobody
Exactly.
could copy it, that
Yeah.
puts you at the, you know, and that was Speranza.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's got a very identical voice, and I love the tone of his voice, and I love his singing, and I love the melodies. I love to sing along with this stuff. They're my favorite song, like "Alter the King" and stuff like that. I mean, God, this stuff's just awesome. Awesome songs. That's the trouble. People are like, "What's your favorite song to play?" And it's like, wow, there's a lot of them, really, a lot of them. But definitely those two eras, and probably because they fit my voice the best.
Yeah. Now they were a Brooklyn band. I grew up in Brooklyn and we all kind of like when I had we had Rick on the show, he grew up like two neighborhoods away from me, you know, and Speranza grew up one neighborhood away from me.
Oh,
And Speranza used to come into a local record store in Brooklyn that my friend owned. And Speranza and my friend knew each other. And they got into it one day when Speranza was talking to him and was telling him, I'm thinking about quitting the band. And the third album had just come out. And they
wow.
got into a heated argument about, you know, and he just really wasn't. And I know this because I actually lived it. He really did not like the rock and roll lifestyle. He really didn't like it. And he had a girlfriend. He wanted to get married. And he just didn't really want to be on the road and didn't want to pursue it.
The way it was explained to me was that he was by the guys in the band that wouldn't have necessarily been directly associated with him, but they said that basically, yeah, his girlfriend, or they always told me it was his wife, but his wife was kind of not so into it. And
Yeah.
yeah, maybe he would. I mean, you can't blame the guy. I mean, your first album comes out in 77, and you got a third album comes out in 81. So you've been, and let's face it, what the Beatles were only together for what so long?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're in there for four, and he start if he
Like
started
five
in 70,
years, really. Yeah. They go back to like 75. They really didn't catch on till 81.
you do something for 5, 6 years, and the thing is, from what I understand, and there was never really money to it. You know, I mean,
No.
whether you want to badmouth Steve Loeb or whatever you want to do, the bottom line is, however the situation was, any money that did come in was basically given to pay for studio time and whatever expenses. And so the guys just never had any money either. Nor did they even have like the rights to their songs. Oh my God, dude, they don't even have the publishing to the
I
songs. It's
know, yeah, I've heard.
so sad.
But the truth of the matter is, they caught on that third album more
Oh
so
yeah.
in Europe than they did in the States.
Well, and they
Because
caught on in Japan even with the first album.
at
I
well,
think part of the reason
yes,
the second album
right.
was called Narita.
Well, Narita helped them out a lot
Yeah.
by using that name, yeah.
But then they never even played in Japan until
Right.
88 or 9 or whatever,
Yeah,
something
they
like
on the Thundersteel period was when they
that.
first
Yeah.
played there, yeah.
And so yeah, it's I don't know. No, I that's man, I would have loved to have seen Guy Speranza live. Got to meet him, same with Mark and everything. That's tough. But
But Rick has played with you guys a few times, right?
Rick, oh yeah, quite a few times. Yeah. We
Yeah.
did we did a tour like in Texas and stuff like that, where we did Thunder, like the whole Thundersteel album. And he came with us to Japan before. You know, he did this thing in Europe with us. Actually, Lou Kavarez came with us to Japan before. And so yeah, we've done some shows with them. They
Well, he
played
had the
in
riot
Japan.
act thing with Lou. That was going on before Lou passed away, and then he put it out after that. And that's when we had him on the podcast at that time when the Riot Act came out.
And I believe the singer that he had in that band has bailed, and so I don't know where he's at with that
Yeah,
right now.
I had heard that too.
He's doing a Bon Jovi cover band.
Yeah,
That's the last thing I heard.
he calls it something. Yeah,
Don Jovi.
Don Jovi. Yeah, Don
For real?
Jovi.
Yeah. Don
Not
Jovi. Don
Don.
Jovi. Well,
Yeah, I'm
I
not.
could go on about Riot all night, but I won't. And I know Mark has some questions about solo albums, and so I'll move on.
Well, I mean, we
Okay.
talked about all the stuff that you've done over the years, the different bands and everything. But let's talk about your solo stuff because it's vastly different right? From I think anything that you've done, whether it's Burning Star or Riot or anything like that. I mean, talk about like the first album that came out, Letters from India, right? I mean, that's just it, I was listening to this stuff and it's all over the place. I mean, it's got like acoustic bass, piano stuff. Do you play on all that stuff?
Well, no. I play piano and I play guitar well enough to write songs, but
Okay.
like if I want the songs to sound good, I'm going to get somebody. Although the acoustic guitar on Letters from India, I did play that.
Okay.
But you don't hear a whole lot of it. It's kind of blended in there. But yeah, I kind of liken it to my dad. My dad's been into cars for many years. And I remember I was a little kid. I remember seeing him sand and do paint and do all this kind of stuff. And now he's at the point where his cars are really nice, and he didn't do a lick of the work himself because he wants the primo work, And so that's kind of my theory. Like, if I want my album to sound really good, I better have a good player, You know what? The solo thing, it kind of snuck up on me, basically. I've always been partnered with somebody else who was predominantly the songwriter. It's the music writer, and I've been the lyricist and the melody guy. That's the way I was with my brother. Although, like I said, in '96, I started playing guitar because I felt like, man, I've got this desire for music, but I don't feel like I have an outlet to be able to create it myself without my brother John. And so I wrote some songs in the '90s, basically, in the early aughts and whatnot, have you. And I pretty much I never learned how to play hard rock metal guitar. I only play acoustic, and so my stuff usually comes out as sappy little love ballads or whatever have you. And so what happened is there was this guy, Francisco Palomo, who is an absolutely he's like the Steve Vai of the piano. I mean, he's that level of piano player. He's so good. He played in Man o' War actually, like with them when they were live. He would play live with them. And he recorded on albums and stuff with them, and that's how I met him when I was doing the Burning Star stuff. And he would be the guy in the studio that would be like, "Oh, you got to do the harmony, okay, Todd? This is what you got to sing." And he would map out all the harmonies for me and stuff. It was just crazy. And so what happened is I went to him one time because I wanted to take one of my choir pieces and just put it to music. I would and. And so, and then, he did that. And then I was like, wow, do you, and it was just piano. It was a song called The Best I Can. And it was just piano and orchestration. And after we finished that one, I was like, wow, like, do you think you could do bass and stuff too? Bass and some drums? He's like, well, yeah. And so I brought out these demos that I had and I kind of started getting excited. I actually wrote like Open My Eyes off that album and stuff like that. It was a new one I wrote on piano and stuff. And so I wrote a couple more. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, like I have an album, and it was songs that I'd written a long time ago for my wife. We, like I told you, we met as pen pals. That's why it's called Letters from India, because we met as pen pals way back in '93. And so that first solo album, I was almost like, I don't want to say this. I don't want to say it wasn't serious, but like I wasn't shooting for the heavy metal market. I
Sure.
put it out and I hope some people buy it. I had all the proceeds go to the City Rescue Mission here in Saginaw, which just helps people in crisis and people, homeless people and stuff. And so I did that. But what happened is I don't know, it just gave me a spark of creativity. And over the course of the next 2 years, I wrote like 30 more songs.
Wow.
And so but for those, I thought, well, I want to go a little more rock. So I ended up working with a different musician in studio here where I'm from, a guy who's kind of really into what I would call power pop or something like that. And I told him I was shooting for maybe a Bryan Adams level of stuff. And so I have basically essentially two full albums of that kind of music too. And then in the meantime there, I ended up going on The Voice and people liked the hard rock stuff. So I ended up this, we almost got on Rat Pack Records, Riot did, right before we released Armor of Light, but it kind of discombobulated at the last minute. But Joe from Rat Pack and I stayed friends, and when I was on The Voice, I called him up and said, "Man," I said, "Man, I've got a bunch of songs written. Do you have somebody who could help me turn them into hard rock stuff?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, I think I got the guy." And he comes back, "I got this guy, Kurt from Metal Church." I'm like, "Really?" And he's like, he's like, "Yeah, man, he's really into that style of stuff. And he's an awesome writer and all that stuff." So he connected the two of us, and that's how we came up with Sonic Healing. And because actually what happened is I showed Kurt a bunch of my songs and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, why don't I just write a bunch of stuff, and we'll see how it comes out, and then we can always come back to your songs. And I've since learned that Kurt, he wants to write his own shit. He doesn't want to play with mine. But Kurt's he's an amazing man. He's an absolute songwriting beast. I'm telling you, like I remember for Sonic Healing, he wrote 18 songs in 21 days.
Wow.
And it was when my business was shut down because of COVID and all that jazz. It was in March. And he and I, it was almost like a contest because he'd be like, I just loaded one to Dropbox. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I just loaded one to Dropbox. Cause like I was getting them and putting vocals. So like within a month, I had written like 16 songs or something like that with him, Like he'd sent music and I would put lyrics and vocal melodies on it. And there was just a real magic about that album. I just, I was just really real magical time for me songwriting wise. And so that's how that one came about. And so then later on we're like, man, we should do this again. And he did the same damn thing. Like he came up with like he just came back and dumped 15 songs on me. Like he can literally, once he sets his mind to it, he can produce like 15 songs in like 2, 3 weeks. Like it's just no,
Wow.
he just makes them. Whereas other people, anybody else I've experienced, but he does music full time, so maybe that helps, like obviously if you're busy working full time and doing all this, like I said, mic running all around, you don't have time for it. But yeah, so that's how those albums came about. And so yeah, so I'm kind of eclectic. People that probably listen to my solo stuff are like, what's up with this guy? Because yeah, you're right, I go to from piano only like tearjerker ballads up to kind of hard rocky stuff. And
We'll
I
talk
go
about
through.
the Elements EPs that you put together in 2019. You had four kind of three song albums. That what was the idea behind that? Like, what how did you develop that idea?
This will sound really, really stupid, but so like basically I was going on The Voice, and when you're on The Voice, they make you sign this contract that basically says they're gonna own everything that you've released if they want to. They can
Oh,
take
really?
rights or something. And they don't ever exercise it, I don't think, because they only exercise it if they end up signing you and putting you on a record deal and all that jazz. And they never do anything for with anybody. If you look at The Voice, they've never been an album released. Singles, but maybe never an album. And so I remember there was people that would bounce from the show because they were so worried they didn't want to give up all their songs. But I was like, all right, whatever. Well, so what I ended up doing is I ended up kind of rushing the Elements out because I thought, well, if I release it before I get on The Voice, then they can't own it. Well, it turned out it didn't matter. They own past, present, whatever. But it was in process and I was working on it. And so what's the reason I did it as four EPs is just because when I looked at it seemed like there was a collection, and I don't know why I was stuck on this notion of Elements. But I just felt like the songs kind of lent themselves to it. And I had this image of pictures of me in fire, pictures of me in like bushes or whatever,
The album
pictures of me in
covers,
the water with the album covers. And the other thing I thought is that if I release it as four, then I can have like different singles on Spotify because everything's single nowadays instead of that. So that's why I did that. I mean, in hindsight, was that smart? Probably not. I mean, it's probably a dumb idea. So that's why when I and I only ever initially released it digitally. And so what happens from that original 30 songs I wrote, that Elements, I got Elements, and I also, not the original ones, but ones I wrote after I was released that one solo album. So in the late teens, early aughts, those songs became the two albums that I put out. So the second album was, and I'm totally forgetting the name of my own album.
No Winner Takes All. Was that
Yeah, it was just coming to mind,
the
No Winner Takes All. And so that was, so when I put out No Winner Takes All, I actually did a physical version of it, but I released it as a double CD so that you could finally get the Elements on CD if you wanted to. I'm weird like that. I'm like this physical guy. I want the CD,
Oh,
So
well, you're
but yeah.
talking to two guys that say the same exact thing.
Got to
Yeah.
be physical
Physical
product.
product,
It's so weird for me because like my daughters finally talked me into, they've had Apple Music or whatever for years, but they finally talked, well, my other daughter wanted, finally I'm like, okay, fine, I'll just buy it, the family one, and so I do stream Apple Music, but it's just weird for me now because I feel like, well, if I listen to something, how do I know to, and they make playlists, but the kids nowadays, they're singles. If they like it, they just throw a single on a playlist and they do that. But I'm an album guy, and so it's just weird for me, like to I don't like I don't know how to find it, like I and this is going to be so stupid, I'm just really used to my iPod, so I'd go to my collection and
That's what I do.
I would dump a mix down, and I would put whole albums on my iPod, and
That's
then
what I do.
I throw my iPod on random, and that's how it is in my car. But now that I'm doing the streaming thing, I also do the streaming thing on Apple, and it's so weird for me. Like, I don't know how to do it because I feel like how do I, I want to listen to this new album, but I don't know. I haven't figured out how to really do it. I feel uncomfortable.
I can't digest an album unless I have the physical copy because I grew up in the 60s and I bought Sgt. Pepper's the year it came out with the big gatefold. And I still have to ha I have to see who the producer is, who the engineer is, who the band members, did anybody change in the band? I got to see the lyrics. I got to see what the guys look like. Is there a new guy? What does he look? And if I don't have that, I can't make a connection and listen to the music. Once I make that connection, then I can absorb the music. If that makes
And
any
I think,
sense.
yeah, no, totally. I think it feels that way for me because I'll listen to it on, like the newest Primal Fear album, like I put it up and listen to it once on iTunes, and then I don't want to say I forgot about it because it was no good, but like I don't have it around to remind me to go to it. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Like,
Yeah,
I guess
exactly.
what I need to do is make a playlist called New Albums on iTunes or Apple Music, whatever they call it. But I think the problem that I have is that I don't have necessarily a ton of times I listen to music. When I listen to music, it's in my car. So if I take a trip somewhere, longer, but usually it's just my 15-minute ride to work,
Yeah.
so it's kind of hard to consume a whole album, listen to a playlist. I don't know, whatever. Just
No, I'm the same way. Yeah.
the whole thing is screwed up now. I'm telling you, these kids and
It
their things.
totally is. Yeah.
Streaming ruined everything. Was there anything
We
else that
know
you wanted
we,
to? Oh, I'm
we,
good.
we,
Yeah.
we know we're old guys now because we're complaining
Yeah,
about kids and music and
this is old guy
right.
talk, yeah.
I know. Yeah, we gotta stop. We don't want to, but Todd, man, we appreciate all the cool stories here. Is the ToddMichaelHall.com still something that people can go to keep up to date?
For
Okay.
sure. For
And
sure.
then you also, we got obviously the Riot 5 thing is areyoureadytoriot.com, right? And so when there's new stuff coming out and then maybe another year or so, we'll
I
keep up
mean,
on that.
nowadays it's so much easier to keep the social media updated. So yeah, if you look at Instagram and Facebook, that's I mean, it's like almost easier. You post that up because the websites can be harder to, the website's where you go if you want to, buy a CD or something
Right,
maybe, but
right.
it seems like Facebook or Instagram and stuff
It's
like that's
instant. Yeah, it's instant. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
exactly.
Well, we'll certainly plug those on the show just to get people to come and check out and keep up to date with you. But that was all you said.
Yeah,
That's
I mean, I could go, like I said, I can go on about Riot all night, but I'm sure
yeah.
you got other things to
Well,
do.
if you can't tell, I can too. That's usually the joke. People start with 10 questions, they ask me three, and they're like, "We're out of an hour." All right, so
Yeah. We'll have to
I
do
don't.
a part two sometime, maybe, and just do concentrate on Riot.
I talk a lot. If you can't tell, so.
No, we appreciate it because
That's all right.
we've had a few guests where it's like pulling teeth. It's like extracting wisdom teeth. Yeah.
To try to get something out of. Yeah, you'll never have that problem with me. If it's a topic I like, I don't. If you pick a bad topic, I don't know anything about maybe. But even then,
Yeah.
I'd
Right.
probably still talk a lot.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure having a talker because we like to talk, we base our podcast on going in depth, we don't like to base it on the 10, token questions everybody asks. So we appreciate the expounding on the answers.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on the show. So,
All right.
thanks very much.
All right. Appreciate it, Todd.
And
Thank you.
I'll
Thank
reach
you.
out to you when it goes up, but it should go up this weekend and then you could
All
share it around and helps
Will
us
do.
out, helps you out.
Will
Awesome.
do, man.
All right.
Sounds
Appreciate
good.
it. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Good night.
Bye-bye.